So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Stop blaming it on holiday stress. We all know it's that time of year when everything feels drained, both your wallet and you. Well, the real problem is right under you. It's that saggy, old, unsupportive mattress. Well, say hello to Ghostbed. Ghostbed is family-run, consumer-loving, with over 20 years of mattress-making mastery. They've engineered the perfect sleep weapon. Durable, insanely comfortable, and cool enough to keep you chill all night long. Every Ghostbed packs their exclusive ProCore technology, a powerhouse support system that cradles your back, supports, and aligns your spine. Translation? You wake up feeling like a human again. Hot sleeper? Ghostbed's cooling materials fight heat 24/7, so you don't wake up sweaty, even when the thermostat that's cranked up. And here's the kicker. Fast, free shipping in just 2 to 5 days. A 101 night sleep trial and up to a 25-year warranty. That's confidence. Right now, Ghostbed is slashing prices. Up to 50% off compared to other brands. And because you're listening, you score an extra 10% off site-wide. Just use promo code PODCAST at checkout. That's PODCAST for 10% off on top of already insane deals. Upgrade your sleep. Upgrade your life. Ghostbed. The coolest beds in the world.
Hey folks, Jeremy Parrish here to let you know that Retronauts is moving. That's right, as of March 1st, we'll no longer be part of the Podcast One network. We've decided to move over to Libsyn. Your podcast subscription should automatically update to reflect this change. But just in case, you can find us at retronauts.libsyn.com. That's retronauts.libsyn.com, beginning March 1st. Not too much will be changing otherwise. There'll be no more political ads, and you'll be able to listen to us on a wider array of platforms, including Google Play and Pandora. But otherwise, Bob and I will continue to bring you new episodes every Monday and every other Friday. And as always, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at Libsyn.
This week in Retronauts, you got your Toki and my Tori. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish. You know my voice. And this week, it's another developer interview with, I'm pretty excited about this one. It's a little studio you may have heard of called Two Tribes that may or may not actually exist anymore. You guys are going to have to clear that up for me. But I've got both of the founders of the company live and on Skype from the Netherlands. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
That's okay. So if there's any kind of like weirdness with the conversation, it's because we're speaking to each other from thousands of miles apart.
Yeah.
But that's technology for you. It makes these things possible. So guys, why don't you please introduce yourselves?
All right, Colin, you first.
Yeah, sure. So my name is in Dutch Colin van Ginkel, or you would maybe say Colin van Ginkel. I'm one of the two co-founders of Two Tribes, and the last 17 years, I've been mostly working on the design of our games.
All right. Yes, my name is Martijn Reuvers, which is a little bit difficult to pronounce in English, I guess. I am a co-founder of Two Tribes as well. And for the past, 18 years, I've been working on mostly programming and early on mostly biz dev, so business development and trying to get new projects signed and everything like that.
All right. And I have been writing about video games for the past 18 years. So
nice.
That brings us all together.
Yeah.
But actually, I'm excited about this podcast because you guys, I don't remember who it was exactly, but Two Tribes was actually the first contact I ever had with a game publisher, a game developer.
I think it was me back then. I think you worked for 1UP, right?
This was before 1UP. This was back in, you know, like 2002 when you guys published Tokitori for Game Boy Color. And I had this dinky little, you know, personal blog. It had like 200 or 300 readers a day. And I wrote about Tokitori. And a few weeks later, someone from Two Tribes wrote and said, "Hey, thank you for the nice review. It was really cool for you to review the game." And I was like, wow, I feel legitimate. That's really great. So
must have been a good rating.
Yeah.
I really liked the game. I thought it was, at the time I thought, wow, cool. A puzzle platform on a game, you know, portable game system. What a great idea. But now that I've actually spent a lot of time exploring the history of Game Boy, I'm like, oh, wow, a puzzle platformer and a handheld. What a great continuation of the great Game Boy tradition from the very beginning.
So
I've got a different perspective on things now. But yeah, Tokitori was a fun little game. And I guess that was the first project you guys worked on as Two Tribes. Is that correct?
It was the first game that we actually released. The history of Two Tribes, it starts in maybe 1998, not 1999, something like that. And I was still in school. I was studying something with information technology, but it wasn't very interesting. So I spent most of my time, trying to understand how the Game Boy worked. And I actually, like, even a few years before, in 1992, I think, we made a small game called Egbert. And it was for the MSX home computer. And it's a system that was mostly famous in Holland and Japan.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think of MSX as mostly a Japanese phenomenon, but I know it did have some traction in Europe. So I guess you got caught up in that.
Yeah, Philips used to make those machines, and Philips is a Dutch company. So they had easy access to the Dutch market. But I don't know, there's still like a homebrew scene for MSX, and for some reason it's mostly Holland, Brazil, and Japan. I really don't know why.
Japan is probably
that's okay.
It was Sony as well, right? It was a mixture between Sony and Philips, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and I think Microsoft was involved in there somehow. So
okay,
yeah, Microsoft made the basic the programming language that you got when you booted up the system. But they didn't make the machine. It was like there were Panasonic, Sony, Toshiba, Philips, all kinds of different brands that were making MSX hardware.
The MSX was more of a standard than a system in itself.
Yeah.
Kind of like what Philips did with CDI, you know, a decade later.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I don't really know that much about MSX outside of Japan. So hearing about, you know, people who did have experience with it outside of Japan is always really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's actually the system on which the first Metal Gear got published. Before there was an NES version, they actually made an MSX version, which is, in my opinion, much better.
It is a much better version.
And so it was interesting to be the underdog in the home computer scene, because everybody had a Commodore 64 or Amiga or something, and I was there on a computer. That's where I met Martijn, actually, on our local computer club, where we used to copy games and make pictures and I don't know, eat fries.
Yeah, I was actually the one with Amiga and a Commodore 64, and you know, he was the guy with the MSX, which is. In my opinion, it was always inferior to those other platforms. So we always got these same battles between which one was better. And in the end, we ended up both with an Amiga, which is, in my opinion, still a very good computer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it definitely for the time, it was hard to beat the Amiga.
Yeah.
So, but to continue my story, when I'm in 92, we released Egbert for MSX, but I did it together with a friend of mine called Stefan Sadovinsky. And then a few years, I didn't make any new games or any other projects. Maybe I was too busy with school, I don't know. So when the Game Boy Color came out, it looked like a portable MSX, because the specifications were really, really similar. So that was why I decided to just ask around if there were more people who wanted to work on something. And actually, I think the first idea was to make a shooter, a little bit like a Gradius or R-Type style shooter, but with a dragon. I remember making artwork for it, and it was supposed to be like a a Gradius style game, but with adventure elements and collectibles and stuff. And then it turned out to be quite difficult to make that. So we decided, oh, we'll just port Egbert because we already had that. We'll just make a quick project. And I think this is about where Martijn came in.
Yeah.
Where he said, hey, can I join you?
Yeah. I'm kind of curious to know more about Egbert. Like, what kind of game was that?
It's basically like a rough version of Tokitori.
Okay.
And it was much more violent as well. I mean, it was made by someone which was a little bit younger, obviously. Colin was, I don't know, 12 or 13 when he started on the game, so it is pretty young. Yeah. And, you know, Tokitori got killed pretty violently with blood, everything like that, and he got shut down.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a little bit... we obviously toned that down for the Game Boy Color version. But aside from that, I guess it's mostly the same?
Yeah, okay. As you say, it also had four worlds, but we changed one of the worlds, and some of the earlier levels we adapted to the new version because they were introduction levels and they were good enough. And some of the weapons are the same. And actually, if people want to play it, you can still download it. If you search for Egbert with double G on MSX, and it's on the domain file-hunter.com, I think. And there you can.
Yeah, and it's made by Phony and with an F.
That was our name back then. But if you look for that, you can download it for free, or there are videos as well, and you'll see it's pretty similar. But like Martijn said, I was so young, I didn't even know what I was doing. So it's something that just evolved into a game. And so when we got the chance to make the Game Boy version, we decided to just go back to the original and see what was working and what wasn't, and we made a lot of tweaks and fixes.
Yeah, like Colin said, we thought it was a quick and perhaps even a dirty version of of Egbert, because we already had the design and a lot of content. Yeah. But even with that, we still spent, I don't know, 2 years on making the game, I guess. We started in 1999-ish, and it was done in 2000, end of 2000.
I think so. It was released in September 2001.
Yeah, but then already it was sitting on the shelf for a pretty long time. So I guess, So give or take, you know, 1.5 to 2 years, I think we spend on it, even while having a lot of content the character and the design. So somehow we didn't know it back then, but for later projects, we turned out to have the same problem for even for the last project. So we always think that we can do it pretty quickly. And then we end up spending 2 or 3 years working on the game. So that's kind of the same story.
We did have a lot of cool stuff in the game that no other game had. So I'm pretty proud of it. And if you're just working out of your bedroom, it doesn't matter too much that you spend too much time on it.
No, definitely not. And we wanted to make, obviously, the best looking game on a Game Boy Color. So we tried to push the most out of that little system. And actually, when it was released, some commenters or reviewers compared it to a Game Boy Advance version of a game, and they actually thought it was a Game Boy Advance title because of the how it looked. But it was just tricks that we did to make the game look better and run.
Yeah, that was something that I was really struck with. Like, it's a very, kind of the presentation is very simple in the game. It's a puzzle platformer, so it's kind of slow paced and, very, straightforward side view. But the animation is really high quality, and there's some really great effects, like, transparency on the water that you really didn't see on Game Boy Color a lot. Yeah. So that was something that definitely stood out to me. So the game came out in Europe before it came out in America, is that correct? Because I remember it came out around the same time as Shantae from Capcom in the US. Feel like it was kind of, yeah, that was like mid 2002. You said it came out in fall 2001. So, I'm kind of curious about the.
It was released on September 11, 2001. So, or 12, I think it was, the day after 9/11. Yeah. So it was, bad timing all over the place. And I actually don't know anything about it was released earlier in Europe, but perhaps Colin knows. No, but no. I think it was all just one release day, that it was September 12, 2011. 2001.
Maybe I'm misremembering a little bit.
I
think I still know. I think McTain is right. It was released on the 12th of September in 2001 in America, and then maybe 6 months later, it was also released in a limited capacity in the UK.
Now I remember.
There's a different box art for the UK version. Yeah. It's slightly different, and I think they removed our logo or something. And I remember being something weird with it. But it was mostly released in the US. And because the Game Boy Color was already being replaced by the Game Boy Advance, Capcom never published more, or did more than one production run.
Right.
Yeah.
I think our logo was blown up. There was something weird with the vector art. Do you remember?
Maybe.
And one of the smiley had, very big lips, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. I don't know.
So that was something a big thing. We obviously spotted that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was only released in a limited amount because it wasn't a bestseller hit, unfortunately. When it was released, obviously, like I said, the day after 9/11, I don't think a lot of people have games on their mind. So that was kind of unfortunate. The Game Boy Advance was already out or announced or something like that. So
I think it was out already.
It was out. Yeah, I think it came out in August 2001 in the US. So it had been out for like a month.
So it was all bad timing. And so had it been earlier, like a year, things could have been different. But who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting stories for me about how we got to have a deal with Capcom is it's quite a special story for me, because we were just two Dutch guys working out of their bedrooms, and for some reason we managed to get Capcom to release the game, make it how to do promotion, go to E3 with Egbert with Tokitori, and the funny thing is that we didn't really think about what we wanted to do with the game. We were just making it. And then when we were almost done, we're like, okay, maybe we should find somebody to publish it. So we went to people in the Netherlands, to some other country companies that were already more established. And we had meetings with them, and basically they said, well, maybe you can get a few thousand dollars or euros or guilders that we still had before the euro. But that's about it, because it's a bad market. Please don't expect too much.
And you have like a non-existing IP, so nobody's interested in it. So it was they didn't see a lot of it in it. So
no. And so we were pretty active in the hobby scene for Game Boy development, and I think it was on ICQ or in a forum or something where we got in touch with a guy called Paul Bregel.
It was ICQ. Yeah,
ICQ. Okay. We didn't know him. We just had talks with him, and he had pretty big words. So he said, I could take your game and I could go to publishers and maybe we could strike a deal.
He already had, just to give you a little background. Sorry. He already had a game company called Paragon 5. And I think at that time he already released some games, so he knew a little bit about the scene and who to talk with and or who to talk to, and so he was willing to take on our game because he thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. So in the end we were like, okay, we're not going to make this work by staying in the Netherlands, but we don't have any budget or anything to go to big conventions or the US or and the market was pretty different because there was not much back then, like not many. There was no indie scene. Nobody was making games. Not many people were making games like we were doing. So in the end, we just said to Paul, "Okay, this is what we want. We just give you the game. You just go to E3, and I think it was E3 of 2000. And then he went to E3. He had some meetings, and he showed us. He sent us an email saying, "Well, guys, you can choose between Capcom, Konami, or I don't know, there was another one. I don't remember which one. And we were like, what? We can choose? And so basically, in the end, we ended up with Capcom because Konami wanted to change the license and add different characters and stuff. And Capcom actually believed in the original ideas, in the original concept, and the way the game was. So
didn't Konami want to attach Calimero to the game, or is just maybe something that is in my mind?
I remember
because I thought it was Calimero that.
What? Curious Sorry? George, actually.
Curious George? Okay.
Yeah, it was a monkey. Is Curious George a monkey?
Oh. Hmm. Yes, Curious George is a monkey.
Okay, yeah, I think that one. Okay.
I could actually see that working, yeah. But I'm glad that you were able to keep the original character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
But the weird thing is, we still stayed in Holland. So we set up our company because you need to sign agreements, so it needs to be all official, and everything went smoothly, sort of, but we never saw Paul, and we never saw the people from Capcom. And at some point, they sent us a contract, and we're like,
all digital, yeah.
Yeah, it's all digital, and why? Well, let's just sign it and see what happens. And then I think we got silent for a few weeks, and then we were afraid that we did something bad or that we signed away.
No, or that people were just pulling pranks on us, because in some weird way we were still thinking, well, perhaps it's just some friends of us that are trying to contact us through internet, and they're joking us with a fake contract, and nothing is real in this, and this is all just something that is not going to happen to us. So yeah. Because we have never seen anybody, like Colin said, so we've never seen Paul or Capcom or anyone, so it could still be a very elaborate hoax, but fortunately it wasn't.
No, I remember one evening we went to the ATM and we got our bank card from our newly set up company, and we just put it in, and there was we did not have any money, so it was always zero, which was our bank account. So we put it in and we just said, okay, give me 100 guilders, so it's like $50 or something, and then it beeped and we got money, and I think we went to get a drink or went to the movies or something from the money.
Oh, I think we checked our balance, and it was because back then it was not easy to do that through the internet. So we checked our balance, and it was, I don't know, $50,000 on there, and it was just big, and it was like, whoa, holy crap! So this is real. So this was the start of our company, actually.
Yeah, that was the moment that we actually had faith in that we could do something like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
to this point, you guys were not really incorporated. It was more just like a couple of guys putting together a game and hoping, you know, that they'd find some way to get it out.
We did establish a company, like Colin said, but we did that mainly because we had to work with an American company, and we were told by a lot of friends and family, like Americans are very scary people to work with, and they sue all the time. Yeah. So you better lawyer up and, you know, at least set up a company that if they go after you, at least the company goes bankrupt and not use you personally. So this is the reason that we set up a company back then, and not necessarily because we wanted to make more games. That I think that decision came a little bit later.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think if you have money, why don't you start a company?
Yeah.
That was the reason behind it.
Then we found out that it was actually possible to sell the game, and then we sat down and thought, okay, if we can do this once, why can't we do it a second time? And I think this was the start, and that was after Tokitori 1, obviously, of Three Tribes, which is a different game, unfortunately, that never got released. Actually, it was never finished, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm actually really fascinated by Capcom from this period, because it's like this, you know, large kind of first tier game publisher that was really taking a lot of chances on kind of unheard of original properties, which no one was doing back then. Like the Game Boy Color was kind of a wasteland.
Yeah, there was this sweet spot that we had back then that Capcom was actually taking on risky projects just to see if anything was going to stick or not. And we were just lucky, and I think Paul played a big role in this one as well, to convince them to take on the game. So I think it was the combination of the fact that Capcom was trying, you know, unproven IP, which was pretty cool. The fact that Paul was able to convince them that it was pretty cool. And another very big factor was that the game was almost ready. I mean, we spent a lot of time on the game and it was polished and it looked fine. Audio was there. It was in no way a demo. So it was a ready product. So when they saw that, obviously they made the decision, well, there is little to lose here. We can just, you know, put it in production and see if anyone likes it. So I think a combination of those factors made them decide to take on the project.
Jeremy, do you know if the Way Forward had the same idea behind that? Or did they feel that Capcom was doing the same thing as we feel?
I've talked to them a little bit about that. And, you know, I think they're really grateful that Capcom was able to or willing to kind of take this risk on them. And it is something that is, it does really feel like sort of a slice of time. But, you know, if you look at Capcom's library from around 2000 or so, not just on Game Boy Color, but also on PlayStation, they were putting out stuff like One Piece Mansion and just like these kind of esoteric niche games that they would never publish now. Like Capcom's business now is very much about like, what's going to sell a million, 2 million units. But at the time, like it seemed like they were kind of willing to put themselves out there and just try different things. And I feel like it was a system working in a good way where they had these, you know, these big hits that made a lot of money for them, like Resident Evil, and Dino Crisis, and Mega Man.
Yeah.
And they were able to sort of parlay that to be able to take risks on smaller companies.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, if no one had bought Toki Tori, it wouldn't have bankrupted Capcom. They could afford to take a chance on that. So, so that's really cool. It's you don't see a lot of corporations doing that now, and I guess they don't have to because there is an actual vibrant indie market at this point. Like that is a niche of the industry. It's not just a niche. It's like a sector of the market.
People are now able to sell their games themselves, and obviously that was not possible at all back then because you needed to have a publisher just to make those cartridges in the first place. So, when you needed to be an official developer to make games as well, which was, we were not an official developer, and this is a story by its own as well. Because, like Colin, I think he already mentioned during this call that we were in the homebrew scene. So, we basically made everything from the tools that were available through the internet back then. So, nothing was official. So when we submitted it to Nintendo, actually they asked us, how can you do this? You're not in our list, so what is this? So they kind of mistrusted us, or they thought, well, how can they pull this off? So we launched a game about a chicken and an egg. Yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah. Because the funny thing is, when we contacted Nintendo, we were actually wanted to become a developer for the Game Boy Advance. And we said, oh, we already have Game Boy Color experience. And they said, oh, that's good, because then we can fast-track you to become a Game Boy Advance developer. So then during the call, they said, what's your name? And we said, Two Tribes. And they say, you don't exist in our systems.
Exactly.
That's true. But we did make a game. Oh, they said, no, that's not possible, because you have to be registered. So for some reason, we got past the security checks at Nintendo or something.
Yeah, but I remember that we had calls with LotCheck, which is the Nintendo checking system to make sure that all the data that you submit and the game that you submit is valid. And we had that during Toki Tori, so we actually had calls with them. But I don't know how they flagged or how they didn't see that we're not an official developer. But my point being. Now it's easy. Anybody can make a game, but back then you needed to be an official developer to make games. And I'm talking about chicken and eggs, obviously, whichever came first. You know, it's not really possible to make games if you're not an official developer. So how can you start being a game developer? Which is a very difficult question, obviously. So we solved that by just going well, making it ourselves through homebrew, and that was our way to into the game industry with a bit of luck, obviously.
So you kind of bluffed your way in.
Yeah. You could put it that way. Yeah, and obviously
we didn't know what we were doing. So
no, we were just making a game that we think was really good, and we just polished the hell out of it. And I guess people liked it, and they had faith in us that we could actually deliver a game.
Yeah, so you mentioned that you began development on Game Boy Color because it reminded you, you know, technically of the MSX.
Mm-hmm.
But was there a sense that like you needed to be on a different platform instead at the time? Like, did you at some point during the development of Togitori, were you like aware that Game Boy Color was kind of, you know, not too long for the world because Game Boy Advance was in the wings? I'm just kind of curious, like, did you just feel like, hey, we've got to stick with this the entire time? Or was there ever any kind of uncertainty about, like, is this the right way to go?
I don't think we had that at any point. I think all the other platforms back then that we were playing were either consoles or, well, that's mostly it. And we considered them to be out of our league anyways. So I think the Game Boy Color was just the perfect fit. And the Game Boy Advance, I think it was a little bit later. And Colin mentioned that we wanted to make our next game on the Game Boy Advance, but because Tokitori was on the shelf for quite a long time, I'm not even sure if we were aware during the end of Tokitori development that the Game Boy Advance was even coming. So
okay, so once the game came out, you know, once Capcom published it, mm-hmm. I mean, at that point, were you guys part of the system? Were you official developers at that point? Did you get kind of grandfathered in?
No. I think this is what Colin tried to explain earlier. So this is the point that we wanted to be an official game Nintendo developer because we have been using the homebrew scene all the time, but we wanted to use official tools because, you know, they can be pretty fast and much better documentation than homebrew documentation and everything like that. So we wanted to do it officially, and then they found out that we were not an official developer. So, we had to prove ourselves by showing that we already had a game out there, and they fast-tracked us.
No, actually, this is an interesting story because they didn't. They denied us access to DevKit.
I forgot that. Really?
Yeah, because back then you had a company, and I think it's now owned by Sony. It was called SN Systems.
And with Pro DG.
Yeah, and they made like dev kits that you could buy if you are an official developer by Nintendo, but it was not the same as a Nintendo developer kit. So they were like, they had an alternative project for people who wanted to make games for Nintendo systems. And so what we did is just, we said, so we were denied by Nintendo to become a developer, and at SN Systems you have to prove that you're a developer. But basically, we just sent an email, and we said, "Okay, guys, this is what's going on. We're making a game, and we need more dev kits as soon as possible. When can you deliver?" And for some reason, they didn't even check, and we just got like next week or the week after, something like that. We got the dev kit in the mail, so that even after that, we had to apply like a year later or something. We applied again at Nintendo, and then they were like, "Okay, maybe." Maybe we can allow you to be part of the developer program.
I forgot that part of Pro DG. Yeah, true.
So we actually bullshitted our way into a dev kit.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Actually, that dev kit was pretty good compared to the system that Nintendo brought out back then. But, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was nice. It felt good.
Yep.
So you said once Tokitori was out, you guys decided, you know, we're a company now, we're going to, you know, pursue this. So you know, what did you sort of set your sights on beyond Game Boy Color and, you know, as your next ventures?
Well, the next venture was the Game Boy Advance. So we came up with this other idea called Three Tribes, which is a, where can you compare it with? I think it was Golden Sun, or was it Golden Age, Colin?
Golden Sun was more like a traditional RPG. So ours was a bit more like...
open world-ish.
Like a bit like Zelda Four Swords, where you like it's like an RPG, but a lot of puzzle elements as well. But with a lot of physics and stuff, so you could just jump on and over stuff, and you can throw stuff, and you can stack.
Yeah, you could pick up sheep and throw them away, and there were chickens, and it was a very open world-ish thing with puzzles, I think. And we spent a lot of time for a vertical slice just to make something that was looking very good and played very good. Yeah. And I think we spent 2 years on that, and we started in 2001-ish, 2002, and it was...
Yeah.
I think we stopped working on it in 2003, and I think, but I'm not sure because it's been a long time, that we only tried to sell it to Nintendo because we thought, well, okay, we already managed to sell it, sell a game to Capcom. This game should be Nintendo worthy. So.
Yeah.
So we spend a lot of time on that, and again, as with Tokitori, at the end of the development cycle, I think Nintendo already had the Nintendo DS on their radar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Game Boy Advance was already, a little bit not that interesting for them anymore, and we only pitched it to Nintendo in Europe. We actually went there with our suits and everything like that. We had a very nice presentation, and then they really seemed to like the whole concept of Three Tribes. But obviously, they needed to have clearance from Japan to do it, because Japan, at least back then, took on all the projects. And unfortunately, they didn't want to take it on. How stupid, I think, in hindsight, we just decided, okay, well, if they don't want it, then it's probably not good enough. And, well, we're not going to continue with this. So we kind of abandoned the whole project.
Yeah, it's kind of silly.
Yeah. So we did.
That's a shame. It sounds like a really interesting concept for a game, or, you know, like a really interesting project. Do you have any, like, I don't know, stuff online?
Yeah, there's still screenshots and movies on the internet. I think there's we collected them and put it on our Two Tribes website as well at some point. And I think if you even go to www.threetribes.com, mm-hmm. that you can actually see some of the artwork from back in 2004.
Let's do that.
So it's 3-tribes, or I think it's like that.
Hey, it's still there, but it says missing plugin because we don't have Flash.
Right.
Yeah, it was made in Flash, I think, back then, because that was the leading thing. But there should be some movies there as well.
No, that's the end.
Now it's the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we can obviously send that to you if you're interested. But the whole thing is because we were kind of green, to say. We were just starting as a company. So we figured, well, if we can make a game... we can make it again, but we didn't have any experience with timings or how much time actually something that you're making from out of nothing would cost. I mean, there was no engines back then that you could use, so we had to make all the technology ourselves. We had to come up with a completely new design with mechanics that were unproven and with a very, you know, limited platform. I mean, it's not a PC where you can throw all kinds of things at and ask the user to upgrade if it's not working fast enough. So it was just a fixed thing. So I think 2 years with only two people, two or perhaps three, we had some interns and people working on the site for us. It was just way too small for even a very good vertical slice, let alone a full product. So I can imagine that if Nintendo would see that they would think, well, this is cool, but to make this into a game, it will take so much more time. And, you know, the Nintendo DS is already coming out pretty soon-ish. So this will be too late. So yeah, that's just how it went, and we decided not to port it for the Nintendo DS because I think back then
actually we did.
Yeah, we did, but we didn't do anything with it. I think we had a one programmer who tried something with it, but I don't remember that we were actively trying to look back then for
we
a
did.
Publisher.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Because we had the same like demo running, but on the DS. The DS was like a Game Boy Advance in 2D. It was pretty similar.
Wasn't that much later?
I think it's 2004 or 2005 when the DS came about. Yeah. And then we decided to give it like one last attempt, just to try and secure a publisher. So I remember making discs with like nice covers.
Yeah. But I think that was after. Yeah, sorry that we're discussing this because it's just
it's 10 years ago.
I think because in 2003 we stopped development on the game. I think because I went to do my graduation thing, or how do you say, my master thesis. And I did not I did not program anymore for that game. So I think the development, aside from some content or other things, stopped around 2003. And we picked up other projects. And later, when the DS, when we were more affluent on the DS, I think we picked it up again, tried to see if we could still pitch it. But it was, in my opinion, too late.
Yeah, I think so.
I think something like that happened. So,
One interesting thing, I was just looking to see if I can actually find the page for Three Tribes. But when I look at the page source, it looks like we've been hacked.
Oh, really?
So there are scripts that go to cheap Nike Air Max shoes .asp.
Oh, my God. And I wonder for how long now.
Yeah, maybe 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah, it could be.
But it's very interesting. Anyway, but so we have been hacked.
All right, this is interesting. I need to check that out if other sides of us have been hacked. But, you know, this is not very important right now. Good. So, but yeah, no, that was already. So it was 2003 though, when we kind of stopped developing that game. I went away to go to Philips to do my my master thesis, and Colin went on. And then I think we started on Worms World Party for the Nokia N-Gage around that time. Yeah, I think it was because that was one when we when I was away.
Yeah,
so
I think so.
Yeah, and so that was our next big venture, I guess.
Yeah, before we jump into kind of, you know, life beyond Tokitori and Game Boy Advance, I did want to ask you one thing about the name. You mentioned you had a game called Three Tribes. The company is Two Tribes. Where did the name come from? Is that a reference to the song Two Tribes, or is that a coincidence?
I think you can tell about the you tell the story.
Yeah, I remember like people asking me like what is the name of your group? We didn't really have an answer, but you have to like present yourself in a certain way. I think before when we released Tokitori on Game Boy Color, we actually worked with a team of two other people as well, or three, I think. One was a programmer, and he was really good. His name was Michiel Frissert, I think. Yeah. The other one is a friend of ours called Laurens van Klaveren. And Laurens worked mostly on the external artwork, so the box art or the logo or things like that. And I think because back then Laurens and Michiel, they were also part of a demo group on the Amiga. So you had their side and our side. So it sort of made sense to do something with that are two separate
two
factions.
Yeah.
So that's why at some point it became Two Tribes, and it sounded okay. And so it stuck. And I don't have a really interesting story.
Yeah, and
but it wasn't a Thompson Twins reference.
No.
Yeah. So like Colin said, it was just because of we used that name, Two Tribes, internally we had like natives as a mailing list, or it kind of made sense to make a game that revolved around natives and, you know, forests and everything like that for our sequel to Tokitori, which was...
Just waiting for a better name to come along.
Yeah. And because Tokitori, when we pitched it to Capcom, it was still called Egbert, like Colin told you that he made it on the MSX. And, you know, the name Tokitori was just, we submitted 10 different names for Tokitori before Capcom chose Tokitori, because they came up with all kinds of different names because they didn't want to use Egbert, because it was already, I think it was already like an IP on the PC called Egbert in the US, so
Speedy
they couldn't use that. So they came up with all kinds of weird names that we really didn't like. So I don't know how we came up with the name. I think in one session when we were eating somewhere, we coined a few names and we put them in an email. And only for, I think, months later, we found out that Capcom already decided to use Tokitori. And, you know, last minute, we had to change all kinds of assets because in our game, it was still called Egbert. So that's, right. This is how Tokitori came alive.
I think the Tokitori was one of the variations of one of the names that we had, which is a Kiroitori. And I think Kiroitori means just yellow bird.
Yeah, exactly.
In Japanese. Mm-hmm. And so when it became Tokitori, we didn't even know what it meant. So in Japan, people are always really confused because it means something like season bird or time bird or happening bird, I don't know.
And actually, it means something in Finnish apparently as well, in marketplace, which is kind of interesting, but it has nothing to do with a marketplace or a time bird. So,
No, we only added a rewind feature when we made the PC version. So
yeah,
right.
It's nothing like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so beyond this point, you guys, I guess, worked on a combination of original ideas and contract work for other studios?
Yeah, well, mostly we entered the phase of contract work for hire. We still tried to pitch our own original ideas, but it was very difficult to get them signed. So it was mostly pitching for, a request for proposal. So we had an idea of a certain that could tie into a certain IP. And then, you give a quotation and they say yes or no. So this is, I think, from 2004 or 2003 onwards to 2008, we've been working mostly on that premise.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess up until the release of the DS and the Wii.
Yeah, I think
it was mostly contract work.
I think WiiWare was the one that made us realize that we could do something ourselves as well. So, so this is a big jump, obviously, from all the way from 2004 forward to releasing our own games again.
Right,
but it was very difficult back then to do anything yourself.
Yeah, that's something I've heard from a lot of small developers is that the middle of the last decade was kind of a wasteland.
Yeah.
There just weren't a lot of opportunities for people with small ideas.
Yeah.
I guess you could make casual games on DS, but otherwise it was pretty much, work on bigger package products for PlayStation 2 or GameCube or Xbox. I've heard WiiWare was kind of like a big sort of jumping off point for smaller studios.
Xbox Live Arcade as well. I think it was earlier than WiiWare, but we were not able to get us signed because Microsoft was pretty tough on allowing content on their platform. And we tried several times to get, for instance, Tokitori on there, but it was not possible. So all those years we've been working. It's not that we did like packages or anything like that. We always made something that was original for us, but it was tied to an IP. Unless, of course, you count in Worms. Worms Open Warfare, we worked on that. We basically took Worms World Party and we tweaked the hell out of it and added some new modes and everything like that and really made it shine, I guess. So we always, even if it was a game that was already out there, we wanted to add something extra instead of just porting it and releasing it and be done with it. But the other games like Garfield or Rubik's that we did in 2006 and 2008, they were all made originally and usually with very tight deadlines as well. So because that was the case with working with publishers as well, they always wanted to have something done yesterday. So the money in retrospect was good because these days it's very hard to make a decent buck, in my opinion, but it's a whole different discussion. So the money was good, but the deadlines were just crazy. It was just stressed out all over the place. And it, I think it was lucky that we were that young back then, because I wouldn't be able to do that anymore now. I think I would just say, well, I don't want to do this. Bye. So it was a different time.
I remember when we got back into development for Nintendo DS, that it felt like a sort of like a liberation, because we were making games for mobile phones for a few years.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like that.
Yeah, that really sucked. Yeah.
Like right now it's okay. It's you just make something for iOS and Android and that's it.
Yeah, even though it gets more complicated again.
You had so many different versions that you had to make. So
yeah, it was really fragmented.
If you made games for mobile phones back then, you basically have a good idea, and then every device that you had to support made the execution worse.
Yeah.
Like there were, for instance, we made golf games, and when a golf ball is very far away, we would just render it with one pixel, just one white pixel. And I remember there was one device that could not make a white pixel. stupid things like that.
Yeah, or just, you know, gameplay technical things. Like you have a D-pad and you assume that you can use up and right and up and left at the same time. But no. Not all not all devices support multiple key presses. So you can think, well, I can go, you know, sideways or with my game, but I cannot do that if the device doesn't support that. So
yeah. So
you can come up with awesome ideas only to find out that it's not working on some weird device that we don't even have in Europe, because I remember that at one point one of our contacts, he sent like, I don't know, 30 or 40 different phones with all kinds of adapters to our office, and we had to test all these games or one game on all these devices, and you had need to have all kinds of installers for that, and it was just crazy. It was really not where we wanted to be at that point.
No. I remember when like the Nintendo DS, the hardware is it's pretty horrible. Like even for the time, it was pretty horrible. One of our programmers said that he thought Nintendo bought it from a street vendor in Singapore.
Yeah. That was the joke that was running in the office. Yeah.
Because it was
a street vendor with sunglasses, Colin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a long raincoat.
Yeah, definitely.
But the hardware was like really limited what you could do. And Nintendo has a way of making cheap hardware that is not like top of the line, but it's like the battery life is good. And in the end, you make it work. But at least it was like one platform with proper controls that you could actually...
one screen size.
You could use diagonal inputs, which it's crazy that you're happy with it. But we were so burned out by the mobile phone business that we were really happy with stuff like that.
And touch input, which was kind of interesting, of course. But
Yeah. And the mic.
Yep. Yeah.
I remember when we started DS development, we started to hire some more people. And at some point, we had like four or five people. And then we did some pitches for, I think it was for Cartoon Network Kart Racing or something. And we made a pitch, and I think they didn't take it, but we got Garfield instead, like a month later. But then the publisher said, well, we want to do, I think it's called Due Diligence. So we're coming over and we want to see how you guys work and see what your technology is like and who are the guys behind Two Tribes. And then we thought to ourselves, well, we're just like four guys who don't really know what we're doing. We were working with one guy in Norway and one guy in England, and we never really knew when they were there.
Yeah, I think we back then had one employee. I think it was Hassel. Just one guy that we, or not even him, but we had a few interns that were working for us before that, and they already were gone. And so we, like Colin said, we had an office which was kind of empty, but there was a big publisher coming over to see how we were working, if we were able to take on the big project.
Yeah, so what we did is we just bloated ourselves and just, like, with the dev kit for the Game Boy Advance, we just, like, bullshitted our way to the contract. So we asked every intern we had in the last few years to come by and, like, bring their old machines and a keyboard from... just to show that we're making music as well.
Yeah.
And we rented a car because nobody had a car, so we could pick the guys up from the airport.
Yeah, it was a very good car, and it was a, you know, a very luxurious car because we knew it was a guy from America, so we had to, you know, please him in any way. So yeah, at least that was the discussion that we had on the office. So yeah. And
so they came over, and they were actually pretty impressed. So we put up a really good show.
Yeah.
And I remember there was one interview.
Sandwiches.
And he said he was the audio specialist. And so he booted up his computer and he tried to play a track. And then the computer said, I do not have enough power to do this.
Yeah, not enough memory. Just stuck.
Yeah. So we were like the whole time they were there. I think they were there for a full day, maybe longer. We're like, oh, they're going to figure us out. They're going to know this is fake. But it, in the end, they approved and we got the project, and that got us back into proper development for games.
The guy from the sound, he could use his mouse, I think, going back and forth, moving on the screen. But if he touched anything, it was just going to crash or showing that it was not working. So he was just sitting there moving his mouse, not doing anything. It was kind of interesting. But we were not like a boiler room. We knew that we could do it, but we also knew that if the guy would see that we were just two guys in the Netherlands or three and two guys abroad, he would think, well, it's pretty cool that you guys are doing this, but we do not have faith in you to execute a big contract like this. Because it was, I think, Cartoon Network Racing or even Garfield that he needed to make a decision on. And we knew that, so we just took a gamble with ourselves. Like, okay, we know we're not going to disappoint you, but you're going to say no if you see the real thing right now. And in the end, the game was good for them. So we proved ourselves right to make a good decision on this. But it was a nice example of bullshitting your way into something.
Yeah, I guess it's one of my favorite memories.
Yeah. So with the contract projects you did, you know, with other people's IPs, are there any that you're particularly proud of that you think, like, we really brought something new to this property that no one would have thought of before?
Proud of? Well, actually, I think Worms Open Warfare, even though it was the most frustrating project that I ever did, I think we made, until that date, the best version of Worms, in my opinion. So I think Team 17, which is obviously the creator of Worms, were very happy with what we did back then as well. So I'm very proud that we were able to beat them, actually, with the very small team that we had back then.
And that was the Engage version of Worms?
No. That was the DS version, the Nintendo DS.
Oh, okay.
Version.
Okay.
Yeah, there were two versions for Nintendo DS. They were called Worms Open Warfare 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And one was made by a different studio, and it I think it got like a 3.0 on Metacritic or something.
Yeah, it was very, very horrible.
It's pretty bad. And then Team 17 decided to use a different developer for the second one. And I think they were making the PlayStation Portable version, which is way more advanced hardware and more capable of a lot more like features, or how do you say? It's better. And in the end, I think if you now look at Metacritic, we have the same... the same rating for the DS and the PSP version. And that's something to be proud of, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember because our technology was pretty much non-existent when we started the project. I think we had a 3D engine from the guy from England called Adrian Brown. But other than that, we didn't have anything. So we basically started, again, all from scratch. And there was our first step into leaderboards, online play, and all that kind of stuff, which was kind of difficult. And I also remember that Nintendo didn't have much experience on the DS for that as well, at least not in the volume that we wanted to do it. So they actually had to come up with lot check requirements for this specific title, which made they actually invented new requirements that were imposed on other developers later as well. So for them, it was all new as well. So we not only pushed our own boundaries further, but I guess we kind of pushed the boundaries of platform holder as well, which was something in hindsight that I am pretty proud of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, considering the way you guys got into being official developers for Nintendo, that's a pretty impressive leap there from not even on the books to kind of changing their processes.
I think we started on Worms at Warfare 2 in 2005 or 6, something like that. And around the time that we were finishing the project, we had 10 to 15 people, including interns, of course. So we were at the top of our game, to say. We were very big and fast, and I think we could do everything.
Well, yeah. Except ship on time. So.
Yeah, well, that was a big problem. With Garfield already, we didn't touch on that, but Garfield was a project that we had to do in, I believe, 9 months or something like that. But originally, we had way more time, like 1 year. But suddenly, the Fox, I think it's the publisher, the movie publisher, they decided to push forward the date. So instead of launching in September, they wanted to have the movie released in July or something like that. So they basically gave us two options. We cancel the contract and you don't get paid anything anymore. Or you guys can work faster and you have three months less to use to complete the project. And obviously, we wanted to complete the project, but it added for, more frustrations and not so much gold plating that we wanted to do.
I think actually it was supposed to be 9 months and it turned out to be 6 months.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
We still had to make all the technology and stuff as well. And I remember when we did the demo that convinced the publisher to let us do Garfield. It looked pretty good, but we spent like 1 week on it.
Yeah.
And then after like 5 or 6 months of like 4 or 5 months of development, it still looked worse than the demo that we did in a week's time.
Yeah.
And they were really worried about that.
Yeah. And then everything just came together very fast. But this is so. I think these days that's still true. There is such a big difference between a vertical slice that looks and play nice and the final product. It's just something that we found out back then as well. I mean, vertical slice is nice, but to get to a final game that is, I don't know how many hours playable, it's just a whole different ball game.
At this point, you guys got back into developing your own original properties, I assume. Like, once WiiWare came out. Yeah.
Yeah. So, because we had some experience on the Nintendo DS, we were still trying to do something. I recall that we were working on a prototype called Rewind, which was an Unreal shooter thing. So around that time, we wanted to see if it was possible to sell that idea to publishers, which was very hard to do. So we were still trying, but it was really not really possible. So we were just continuing.
Yeah, trying.
Yeah, we were continuing on the path of work for hire up until 2008 when we released the publisher, I think it was called The Game Factory. They released Rubix, and that was our introduction to like full blown consoles, because it was Rubix was a dual title for the Nintendo DS and for the Wii, and that was, I think, our biggest stress project ever. So we had to make a game in 9 months, something like that, Colin.
Yeah, for two
different platforms,
systems.
And it was all composed of mini games, which was I think the big thing back then. So we had to come up with 12 different games for two platforms, six games per platform. It was just crazy. And on top of that, we didn't have any technology on the Wii. And remember, back then there was no Unity or anything like that that you could just tap into and you have a game running. So we had to make everything ourselves. And that was a big one. So what we wanted to do with Garfield, we wanted to do it again with Rubik's, but that was just, I think it was too much.
I remember crying I had an anniversary, like dinner somewhere in like a fancy new restaurant, and I was just crying the whole dinner.
Yeah, it was just too much.
Yeah. But like Mahin said, if we were much younger back then, and then you don't really know where your limits are, so you just keep pushing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's just, there's no stopping anymore. You just start to cry.
Yeah.
I think right now there's a lot of people talking about crunch in the games industry. And I remember back then that it felt like having fun with friends. because everybody who was working for us, even up until the end, they always said it felt like a family.
Yeah.
So I remember when we used to pool, like, I don't know, like 4 weekends and 4 weeks after each other, and like continuously. And at the end, you're really tired, but you're also really happy because you made it. So back then it felt like a good thing, but now I know it's not, because I've, like, after that multiple times I felt like totally burned out because of a project. And so I'm happy it's being touched up now by the press and reporters doing research on it, because it is a big problem. It is.
Yeah, but I also talk to the guys that are that work at our office, and usually they don't have any of those crunch times anymore. So it was something that was kind of prevalent back then, more I guess than it was right now.
Yeah, but at least for the people that are companies now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But at least those big companies like Guerrilla Games and everything like that, they don't have the type of weeks and weeks of overtime that we had back then. It was just I think an example of, because our technology was not there yet, that we had to continue working on that like in overtime, because otherwise we were not able to finish the game in any way. And bigger companies might have more financial resources to just say, well, we'll just delay this. And and back then this was our lifeline. If we didn't make a milestone, the publisher could say, well, we're not going to pay you anyway, and then it's just the end of your company. So there was a lot of stuff at stake back then. But the biggest thing that was on stake, obviously, was our health, and we kind of took that for granted. So,
yeah, but that's, yeah. I mean, you learn about stuff. So.
Yeah,
it's one of the lessons.
Don't want to do that again. So that was 2008. Yeah, and I from here on, it's a pretty easy jump to 2009. I think we started in 2008 for working for WiiWare. We were already trying again to go on Xbox Live Arcade with Tokitori. We were working with older. I mean, there's been multiple versions of Tokitori throughout the years. The first one, obviously, being on MSX. Then later, Game Boy Color. But we also released it on Windows Phone. That version was made by friends of us called Code Glue. They're also based in the Netherlands, and they were founded around the same time that we founded Two Tribes. So they made a Windows phone version, and because it was running on Windows, we used that one as a starting point for the Xbox Live version of Tokitori. We went to Microsoft and talked to them, say, look guys, we want you guys to release this game on your platform. But because it wasn't original, because it was already on the Game Boy Color and or Windows Phone, they were not really interested. Perhaps also because there was no multiplayer in it, and they had all kinds of checklists that you needed to comply with before they were even allowing your game on the platform. So we shifted towards WiiWare, because Nintendo announced their digital downloads store for the Wii. And obviously back then in 2008, the Wii was already out for 2 or 3 years, and it was big. I mean, there were, I don't know, 70 million units sold. So for us, this was the big thing. I mean, if Nintendo announces a digital platform, and we were still pretty cozy with Nintendo because we have been working on the Wii, on the Nintendo DS and the Game Boy Color. So we figured, well, this is our big step. So that might made us decide to go to make something ourselves again, to see if it was possible to make money out of that. And it was partly because we wanted to be independent. Everybody wants to be independent, I guess. And also because we found out that it was much harder to get work for higher projects with decent budgets at the end of 2008, around that time. Because earlier it was pretty easy to get, I don't know, just saying 300,000 to 500,000 euros for a project, which is pretty decent if you want to work on that with a couple of guys. But back then, I don't know why, but the whole thing just dropped to ridiculously low prices, at least for the publishers that we've worked with.
I think they discovered that it's difficult to make money on the Wii. Because many units were sold, but third-party software doesn't really sell.
Yeah, you get a lot of shovelware and all that stuff, so they were just well, okay, well, the prices just go low because other developers could make it cheaper. I don't know. So it was very hard to get a decent buck on there. So it was. So there were basically two reasons that we made the step into publishing ourselves. One of them being it was harder to get money for work for hire. And the other one, which is obviously the one that we want to tell as much as possible, that we wanted to make our own games and be able to release them. So finally we could work on our own IP. So that was the big transition back then.
Yeah, but I think we're kind of scared to do it with something new.
Of course, yeah.
So we ended up doing Tokitori again.
Of course, yeah. It was a recurring chicken.
Right, but you guys started developing Rive around that time, didn't you? It just took a long time to come together.
No, Rive was later.
No?
We did make Rewind, which is, well, we could say that at least some ideas that ended up in Rive were we worked on early in 2005, but we completely abandoned that project. Rive was not started on until 2013.
Okay, so the research that I did was incorrect.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'll
correct Wikipedia.
Yeah,
yeah. The thing is that when you have an idea for a game and you cannot make it, at least as a designer, it stays in the back of your mind until the time comes that you can actually do something with it. So the core idea for Rewind was that it was supposed to be like a short game. It was a 3D on rails shooter for Nintendo DS, but it was supposed to be a short game where there was a time loop element where you would play a section and then you would rewind time and you would replay the same section, but it would be different this time because you learned something new or there was an event that happened in the past that changes everything in the future. And so when we decided to do Rive, the project name was still Rewind.
Yeah.
But then we decided, well, let's just make a 2D game out of it, and see how we can do the time travel thing in 2D as well.
Yeah.
And then we started making the game and we tried to get the element into Rive, but it didn't really work out. And so in the end we ditched it and we just made Rive into the best shooter that we could do, that we could make. But without the demo of Rewind in 2005, it would have been a different game. So
yeah, perhaps we wouldn't even have started on that game because the whole idea of reusing content and rewinding, collecting energy, that was something that we started on early somewhere halfway 2013. So because we already had that idea, so... perhaps we completely made a different game if we were not been working on it in 2005.
Yeah, so your research is partly right, but it wasn't in like active development.
But it was not in 2009 because then in 2009 we actually did some other games. We also started on the iPhone. We were one of the earlier people that were having a game on the iPhone. And for the Wii, we also tried something called Demolition, because there were a lot of physics-based games back then, and we always wanted to see if it was possible for us to make something like that as well. So we spent a lot of time making, again, a pitch for Nintendo and other big publishers to make a game in which it was awesome to blow things up and make videos of that. So we had this crazy idea that was awesome to capture those videos inside the game and publish them on YouTube. For back then, that was pretty, novel because that was not possible in other games. But the game again was just like Three Tribes. It was just way too big, and it was very difficult to even get a vertical slice done properly. And unfortunately, it never took off.
You guys ended up going with Tokitori 2 as your first kind of big self-published title, right? And that's a much more, I would say a larger, much larger scale game than the original Tokitori, not just in terms of visuals, but in terms of the design of it and the structure and everything.
In 2009, we released Tokitori for the iPhone, and I think in 2008 we had Tokitori for WiiWare. And after that, we started to see if it was possible to take on projects or games from other developers that were, for instance, on the iPhone, but were not on Wii or not on Steam, because we, in 2010, we also released our games on Steam. So we wanted to act as some kind of, I would say, a porting company, but not necessarily. We wanted to improve games that other people made for other platforms, but were not able to make those games on other platforms. So, for instance, Edge is one of the games that we made for Steam and for the Wii U. And I think there was another platform, another big one that I'm just forgetting. But yeah, exactly. Yeah. So and the developer of Edge, he only made it for the iPhone, but we thought it was a pretty cool game. So we contacted him, and we worked together to see if it was possible to pick up his game and release it on other platforms. And we did that a number of times, because back then Unity or tools that are more cross-platform, they were not as good as they are right now, and almost nobody, or at least compared to now, nobody was using that. So we were kind of having a head start, because we were able to have an engine that was running on the iPhone, on the iPad, and on the Wii, the Wii U, on all those platforms. So we were able to make a bridge. So between 2009 and 2011, we did a lot of those projects. But, the designers and the programmers even as well, they were kind of fed up with porting and improving other games, so they wanted to do something for themselves again. Yeah, and this is basically how we started with Tokitori 2.
I remember around that time when I would go to conventions or something, and I would introduce myself. Sometimes people would say, "Oh, you're the guys who made Edge. That's really a wonderful game."
Yeah.
I would feel like, yeah, okay, we made it better than it was. We improved it. We made some new levels, but it's still not our game. So it felt like we were not, like, I don't know. It didn't feel as satisfying as making new things or feels. So I guess that's why when did we start Tokitori 2? 2011?
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, just after we did some games on Steam.
Yeah,
and, we kind of abandoned the iPhone back then, because there were too many games coming out there.
Yeah, and it was free to play mostly, and that's not what we like doing.
Yeah.
But I remember, because Steam was pretty good back then. There were not a lot of games. I guess there were maybe 200 or 300 games in total on Steam. And now you get 200 games every week. And we were pretty fast with making our existing games for Steam. So within a year, we had 3 games. And every time you would put on a sale, you would sell like 20,000 copies or something. And right now, you have to struggle to sell something like that in the lifetime of a game for a lot of titles. So I think because we were feeling good about ourselves, and we thought it was a good market to be in, and we had some extra funds, we thought, okay, what do we really want to do? If we want to make an original game, what does it feel like? What do we want to do? And I guess Tokitori 2 was the obvious choice.
Yeah,
because we had so much to thank for Tokitori, because it started our company, and it like got us in the right direction again with WiiWare and doing our own thing.
And we decided to
give it a go.
We always felt that, like you said as well, Jeremy, earlier, like Tokitori again. We always felt that we were doing it a little bit too cheap by taking Tokitori all the time again and again and again. And so we thought, well, we owe it to the fans of Tokitori, which were a lot back then, to make something that was not a cheap sequel to Tokitori, like just a new version with some new additional items and be done with it. So we wanted to make a game that was from scratch better than the original. So this is how we basically started Tokitori. And, you know, in hindsight, there's a lot of hindsights here. I think we shouldn't have done that. But yeah, that's a different thing. You cannot change the past, obviously.
So kind of, I feel like your sort of big self-published games have been Togitori 2 and Rive. Can you kind of talk about like what you wanted to accomplish with those games and, you know, what you think you did well, what you could have done better? I'm curious to kind of, you know, hear the post-mortem on those projects.
All right.
Well, I think Martijn, he just concluded with, we shouldn't have done that. And that's because after Tokutori 2 Plus was released, or Tokutori 2 and later Tokutori 2 Plus, we went bankrupt.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a dark side of our, or dark part of our history.
Yeah.
But the idea for Tokutori 2 was that we had so much more knowledge and there was so much more going on in game development these days. There were so many more genres and so many more inspiration to choose from that we decided to try and make something that would satisfy players of the original. So we set out to analyze why Tokutori 1 was interesting for people. And one of the things is that in Tokutori 1, everything is always fair. So if you look at the level, you see what it is, and you look at your items, and in theory, you could just think of a solution before you even start playing. And so one of the, like, there are many games that when you walk around, sometimes there's an enemy that comes out of nowhere and kills you. Or at some point, something that, like a door that doesn't open but is shut for some reason that you don't know, like the Resident Evil games. You have so many doors that are shut that you don't know why.
You need the magic key, Colin. Come on, you need to understand that.
I need the red key for the red lock.
I need the blue key
for the blue lock.
Yeah, you cannot blast with a shotgun through those wooden doors, which is really stupid. No. So, yeah.
You need a small key.
Yeah.
So what we decided for Tokutori 2 Plus early on is that everything needed to be logical. So everything needed to be adhere to the rules that we make. And in the end, what we created is sort of like a living and breathing ecosystem of creatures that have like predictable behavior. And if you combine those behaviors with each other together, you can you can solve puzzles and you can get Tokutori to places that he could not reach otherwise. But the most important thing is that whatever we do, we always keep it consistent. So it has to be really honest from it has to feel honest for the player to solve the puzzles. So I think that was one
idea.
Of the things. Yeah. And the other thing is that Tokutori is really useless. So in Tokutori 1, on the Game Boy, we had a jump button, but he would jump 4 pixels high, and the lowest barrier is 8 pixels.
So it was really stupid.
Yeah, we actually allocated a button to it because people said, oh, I need to be able to jump. I need to be able to jump. And we said, it's useless, but we made a jump button anyway.
Yeah.
So for Tokutori 2, we decided to keep the same uselessness of Tokutori and just figure out what does a chicken do? Well, he doesn't jump. He doesn't fly because he's too fat. And so we just give him 2 simple tools. And one is to whistle because, I don't know, chickens don't really whistle, but he has a beak, so it made sense. And he could stomp because he's really fat. So if he stomps on the floor, it creates a shockwave. And if he whistles, there is a range within where other creatures can hear him and respond to him.
Yeah.
And so the idea was to keep it simple like that. Just 2 buttons. Just walk around. No jumping. No acrobatics.
No text.
No text. That was interesting as well.
Yeah.
And also no text. We wanted to make a game without any text and just let the in-game events guide you to the next part.
Yeah, and the observations of the player. If he takes notice of the environment around him and he learns of the creatures, what they do, how they react, he also would be able to figure out what to do, how to solve puzzles without us hand-holding and telling him what to do. That was the idea, and that was the goals that we set for the game, for the design.
And the funny thing is that back then a lot of people complained that it was too confusing. Where should I go? What should I do? Because we don't tell you what to do. And I think now there's a bit of a renaissance of games doing that, The Witness, pretty recently. Basically, it doesn't tell you anything. It just puts you in a place and lets you figure it out for yourself. And so we still have a WhatsApp group, a chat group with people from our that worked for Two Tribes during the years, throughout the years. And when The Witness came out, they all said, "Ah, it's like Tokitori 2 without the chicken." So a lot of the principles in Tokitori 2 are also used in The Witness and in other games since then.
Yeah.
And so I think we were onto something, but I think Martijn mentioned the text because in the end it was a mistake not to use any text at all. Because sometimes people need at least some clarification on what something means. So you can have really good items or like graphics for icons for where you have to go, or you can put like subtle references to places. Like in the background, we would have pictures of mountains that you had to go to. And so it was always possible to figure out what to do next. But if you missed a clue, you couldn't really... you didn't know that you would miss something. So
yeah,
in the end, it would have been better with a little bit of more text.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things that I think that the biggest problem that we had with Tokitori 2 was that we just didn't have enough time because the money was running out of we were running out of money. It was as simple as that. We were pretty good on finances when we started with Tokitori 2 because otherwise we wouldn't have taken on a project that we would figure would take at least 12 months. But for it to take 2 years was just a little bit too much. Yeah. And I remember that I had this talk with Colin, I think it was in December 2012, and basically the game needed to be launched back then, money-wise. So we sat down and we played the game, and I said, well, I understand now that we cannot release this, because it's just, to be honest, it was just shit. It was not there yet, you know? So it was... Everything was coming together, but at such a slow pace that it was not there yet. So we had to make a lot of concessions in terms of design and play testing and everything like that, just to get it out of the gates. And I think from December to April, because we launched it on the Wii U in April, it's just 4 months. And I think the version that we released later on Steam, which was in September, which took on almost half a year longer, which much, much better. And I think if we had like one more year extra, all those things that people really don't like about Tokitori early in the early version of Tokitori 2, we were able to find those issues and address them had we had more time for that. So it was just a combination of being too... We took on a project that was just too big, again, with technology that we needed to make ourselves for the set time that was just too short for our goals. I mean, Tokitori, I don't know how many hours you can play in that, but it's way more than 20, I guess, if you want to solve all the puzzles and you start out as a fresh guy, which is crazy for an indie title that, you know, so... While working on a game like Tokitori, we buried ourselves, basically. We didn't take any attention on the changing market. Steam was... we were pretty close with Valve. We've worked on the Portal 2 announcement back in 2011. We actually went to their office and were part of a small development team that was promoting inside our games an IP of Valve, which was awesome. But in 2 years later, you know, in 2013, we haven't been releasing any games at all on Steam. And suddenly we were expecting there to be, a lot of buzz from Valve around Tokitori. But, you know, they moved on and a lot of other people were tapping into Steam. So we were basically putting on, blindfolds, and we just worked on Tokitori for 2 years, not paying attention around us. And just feverishly working on a game, so that didn't help either.
I guess in exactly 2 years' time, Steam changed from being a super closed ecosystem to opening up.
Yeah.
And so, actually, when we released Tokitori 2 on Steam, we decided to do it inside the summer sale because that was the one way to guarantee like a front page ad. Because otherwise you would drown in releases anyway. So by the time that we were releasing Tokitori 2 for Steam, we were pretty scared of the market already.
Yeah.
By the time we started, it was like the best. It was a gold rush. It was the best market ever. Like everything we did was gold.
Yeah.
Golden. So It was kind of difficult to see the market change and not being able to release it yet, because we were just not done. We're just not ready with it yet.
No, no. And another thing, I mean, compared to other games that have no text and everything like that, I think Tokitori, in hindsight, might have been a better game had we not tied it to Tokitori, but to a different kind of character with a different setting. I mean, we wanted to solve that problem that Tokitori just looks too cute for it. You know, it's a puzzle game, but it's a very devilishly difficult puzzle game. I mean, Tokitori 1, I remember one guy who was having almost nightmares and he was dreaming about Tokitori, about solutions and everything like that. So it's definitely not a kid's game. Perhaps the first levels, they are able to be played by little children. But later on, it's just very, very difficult. And this was a problem that we always had with the IP. And we wanted to address that for Tokitori 2. But I don't think we did that. Perhaps we even made it worse because the game is not hand-holding anymore. It's not explaining anything. And yet the puzzles are perhaps even more elaborate as compared to Tokitori 1. So I think if you just judge the game by its looks, it's a different title. So people might not spend as much time on the game as they would have been had it been had it had a different look or anything like that.
Yeah, it doesn't really communicate that it's an open world puzzle adventure.
No, no.
Which is difficult to communicate, of course. But
yeah. So that's one of the I think mistakes that we or one of the things that we should have had addressed, but we didn't. So there was a lot of things that were going wrong with Tokitori, but it's always easy to talk about things that are going wrong. Perhaps if Tokitori sold awesomely, we could have had the same discussion and saying that we were awesome in taking the chance, and that, you know, it's the coin flipped the wrong way for us. So
yeah, if we released it a year before, which was the intended release date, it could have been much different.
But
you never know.
All right, so By comparison, do you feel like with Rive you guys, you know, accomplished what you set out to with that game and, you know, found greater success both, you know, commercially and creatively?
No, commercially it's a different story. I mean, I can tap into that for just a brief moment. The difference between 2011 and 2013, at least on Steam, was very noticeable. Between 2013 and 2016, when we released it on Steam when we released Rive, it was even worse. So all the platforms that we released it for, PlayStation 4 and, you know, all the others, they were not anywhere close as we had with the earlier sales that we had, I don't know, in 2009 and 2010 on Steam and the Wii.
I think even Tokitori 2 did much better than Rive at the beginning.
It was going down, and even the game itself, I think Rive for me is I think the best game that we've ever made because everything just fell together. People might not like it, but I think there's not a lot of things design wise that we could have done much better. But the whole landscape changed, and somehow it was commercially okay, but not. It was let's just put it this way. We cannot make a new game out of the income that we made for that game. So it's nice to close a studio where we are right now with that last game. I mean, that's just it. But it's not a sustainable business model, at least not for us.
So I guess that comes to the point of why you guys have closed down. But before we talk about that, I would like to talk about, you know, kind of what you feel you accomplished with Rive, you know, on the creative side. Like it's definitely a different kind of game than, you know, people might expect from your earlier work, especially something like Tokitori, which is very methodical and slow paced. Well, not just the cute element of it, but also like the speed of it. Rive is very frenetic and it's very, very intense and very kind of unforgiving. Like if you're not very careful about how you play, you'll get overwhelmed by enemies and that's it. But it's like super fast, super fluid, really different.
Yeah, like, can I, before Colin gives his perspective, which is the big one because he's the designer, I think for me, what I wanted to do with this project is because we just went through a you know, bankruptcy, so there was a lot of frustration. So it felt really good to make a game that in which you could just blow up everything, shoot everything to pieces, and release that anger. So for me, it helped that we could finally shoot things and not be puzzly and all those, you know, open world things anymore. Just easy shooting things. That for me, that was a very big plus point. So that made working on the game just really awesome.
What Martijn said is I worked on the design mostly of Rive. So it's like level design, enemy design, and overall game design. But I remember making Martijn really unhappy with an interview a few years back. And it was an interview when we announced Rive. People asked me, like, why are you making Rive? And I told them that I had an epiphany that at one point I was looking at what we made with Tokitori 2 Plus, and that even though I think it's a really good game. I mean, people who like puzzle games really like it, and it's not super successful, but I really stand behind the quality of it. But
yeah, definitely the version that's available right now, which is much, much better than the original that we released in 2013. But, you know.
Yeah, but what I said in the interview is that I wouldn't have bought it myself if I was a customer, and if I walked into a shop or I saw the PlayStation Store or something, I wouldn't have bought Tokitori 2 Plus, which was a bit of a weird revelation for me because I spent 2 years of my life making the game. But in the end, I concluded that I wasn't making the game for myself, but I was like, I had an intended audience, and I thought we have to make people happy who... who play Tokitori, the original, and in the market there's a lot of stuff around Metroidvanias now, so maybe we can use that as well a little bit. And so with Rive, the big difference is that we just wanted to make a game that we liked ourselves. And because we went bankrupt, we had to let go of all the people we had, and I think when we went down, we were with 10 or 12 people. And in the end, we had one guy making artwork for us, and he was working for us for like 6 years already. And it was just me and Martijn. So instead of having to manage a studio, we could just say, okay, we ran through a tough time, but now we're creatively free to do whatever we want.
Yeah, we already had an engine as well, even though it was the Tokitori engine, and it was, you know, based around tiles and chickens, but we were able to convert that and get a head start instead of having to build everything again ourselves again. So, and that was the big holdup for Tokitori 2. So that was one of the things that we wanted to safeguard ourselves against going redefining the whole engine again, saying, no, we know what this thing can do. Let's make a game that fits into that and get the most out of the engine instead of recreating the wheel again.
And so I think one of the other things that allowed us to do that is that when we had to let go of the other people, in the end, we still made a few ports of our games for Wii U. And I think that provided a lot of the income for us to allow us to actually work on Rive for as long as we did.
Yeah.
So this is a big thank you to the guys who actually stuck with us till the end. Mm-hmm. Even when they heard about us going down and that they were going to lose their jobs, they still stayed for weeks until the very last moment, and they helped us make Rive as good as it is today. So a big thank you to those guys.
Yeah.
So what do you guys foresee for the future? I mean, I know that Two Tribes was officially closed down at the end of 2016, but you are still supporting Rive, and you know the Switch version just came out a few months ago, I guess like half a year ago at this point.
Yeah.
So it seems like there is still some kind of Two Tribes thing happening, even if you're not, you know, like an entity right now.
Yeah, actually, I am still working. I never stopped working for Two Tribes, so there's a little bit of difference
you said
there.
You did.
I said I did, but I never did. So I continue working because Nintendo announced, obviously, the Switch Switch platform. And I think it was a very interesting platform. And we wanted to make the loop, or how do you say, the circle complete by, you know, finishing on a Nintendo platform and not on a PlayStation or on Steam. We started on the Game Boy, so we wanted to end with a Nintendo platform as well. And it just fitted, when I tell this story, it just fits because Nintendo released the Switch. And I think it's an awesome platform. So it didn't make any sense at all to make all those games not to be on Switch. And we also saw how many people were enthusiastic about the Switch, way more than they were enthusiastic about the Wii U. So at least from my perspective, I wanted to add some extra time to get all those games on the Switch. So I'm just still working with Into Tribes, but the difference being that we're not taking on any new IP, new projects, or anything like that.
Do you guys foresee yourself working on new projects, maybe not under the Two Tribes name, but, you know, like continuing to work in game development? Or do you think it's time for you to move on and, you know, you've done what you set out to do?
I'm done with it. I like the games industry because it's a creative place to be in. But I don't like the uncertainty of working on projects for 2 years and not knowing if you'll make any money back.
Yeah, that's a really shitty thing. And there's no uncertainty anymore. It's just certain that you're not going to make any money.
No, that's not true. There are people that are better than we are.
Yeah, but for us, that's the certainty. Yeah. Obviously, I know that there is success out there because otherwise there wouldn't be so many studios. But for us, the certainty is it's not going to happen. So we need to realize that and accept that.
So dinosaurs.
Yeah, we're dinosaurs, and I mean, we've been unlucky for some times, but I think right now we're completely out of what is hot and what's not, and the technologies we're still using, the engine that was that we started on working with the English guy that I told you about in 2006 or 2005. So it's different, of course, but it's still based on that original engine from back then. And we're not having a studio like a Guerrilla that has 300 people, a lot of them being coders, that is able to make an awesome engine and do everything with it. So we're always limited with those things, and it doesn't make the development of games any faster. So for us to change to a different engine would require just too much, and we just don't feel doing that anymore.
So no, we have from a creative sorry.
Yeah. So for us, from that point of view, we're dinosaurs. We're kind of slow in adjusting or adapting or taking on new things.
Yeah. And for me, from a creative point of view, it's kind of how do you say it? Demotivating?
Can you say that? Yeah. That's yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of demotivating to put your heart into a design and to know that it's the best that you can do. And in the end, it doesn't have to be a commercial success for me to be happy with the end product. But like the uncertainty that you get while you're making it, that, oh, maybe this one is not going to be as good as I expect, or maybe people will not care, or, my conclusion is that we just don't really know what people want, because a lot of the things behind our, success or failure or whatever you want to call it about our history, it's never been that we know exactly what people want. We just know what we want to make. And it looks like people who are having a lot of success now, they just know exactly where to be in the market and like when which genre is going to be hot or like the small niches that they can play perfectly. And that's also a large part is marketing. And that's what Martijn also said about Tokutori 2 Plus. It's like from a marketing perspective, it's a bit difficult to sell a cute-looking game that's actually like a really difficult puzzle game.
Yeah.
So I guess we never really, really understood how to make that work. And that's okay because it's one of my limitations and I'm okay with that. But that's why I don't want to take another gamble on something that I don't feel I have a good grasp on.
Yeah.
But that's it for me personally.
I mean, now you're saying that that it's you or me or... it's always easy to say that's. I think I said this before. If you have a success, it's easy to say or pinpoint perhaps why you have that success and what you did right and everything like that. But if you don't have a success, it's pretty difficult to lay a finger on what it is exactly that you did wrong. If the game is pretty good, so you could always say, well, blame marketing. You should have done this better. You should have done that better. But we've been in this market for almost 20 years, So at least something, I guess, we should have learned and applied. And we've had our contacts within Valve and Nintendo and everything like that. So I think compared to other developers, we were already above a lot of them. And still, we were not able to make money to support new games. So the question really is there something that you can do to guarantee success in this industry? And I think the big publishers know that because they are, you know, taking on the big IPs and throw real big money at it. But I think the indie developers, I mean, sure, you always have these guys that are very, very good at marketing and everything like that. But I think a lot of those things also come down to just being lucky. And perhaps it's just easy for me to say that, but that's what I really feel. Because I know that we're not making shitty games, and I know that we could have promoted them better in some ways. But like I said, I think we already promoted them better than other games. And there has also been examples of people that didn't promote it at all, and yet it became a huge success. So what it is that is actually making a game great, it's just one of those million-dollar questions that in 20 years I'm not able to answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so not being able to answer it, but knowing that you're not making any money out of it, it just makes the decision to not take on any new projects very, very easy, actually.
All right. Well, that's, I can certainly understand.
It's a depressing end.
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, it's, I think it's a reality of the industry that doesn't really get addressed that much is, you know,
it's
tough out there. And for every success, there are lots of studios who pour their hearts into their work.
I don't want to interrupt you, but it's kind of frustrating to be in the industry and not being able to release all those. I don't want to be the negative guy, you know, but sometimes when you read all those messages, it seems as if there is, you know, money everywhere. And the reality, at least for us, and I know that we're not alone, is that it's not like that. Somehow only the big awesome stories they tend to bubble to the surface, and especially because you're with these NDAs and platform holders don't want you to talk about shitty stories, you know, about bad sales or anything like that. If you sell a million copies on a Switch or everything like that or anything like that, sure, you can put it out there, and I'm sure Nintendo or Steam or whatever, they will like it because that's awesome, right? But if you say, well, I sold, I don't know, 1,000 units on Switch or on Steam or anything like that, I'm sure that they will give you a call and say, you should not publish those numbers. They are hurting our platform. So you always get these biased things from within the press that I'm not very happy with. So, yeah, it can be, if you're from the outside or if you're thinking about, well, I want to make a new game and I'm willing to go into this industry, well, sure, try your luck. I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't try, but be prepared. There is a difference between trying a game and you in your free time, like we did back in 1999, and hopefully you're successful, but building a business out of it and making sure that you are continuously successful, that's a whole different game, and that's really difficult. So
I think for me, after we decided that Rive was going to be our last game, we went to a few more conventions, to a game developer conference and Gamescom, and one moment in particular stood out to me when I realized that I was just a dinosaur. It was just too old to be in this industry, and that it was. I hate clicker games. I think clicker games should not even be called games because it's nothing.
Well,
it's
just, I actually like them, Colin. So, but continue. But
it's not my cup of tea. But so I heard about a guy who was making his game, and I asked him how do you finance your game, and he said, well, I'm making this game, but to finance it, I made a really good clicker game that's free. But in the clicker game, there's a Twitch button, and if you click the button, then you go to the development feed where we work on our other game, and then people can press the button to donate money to the development of that game. And he got like 10,000 euros every month on his game. And I hate clicker games with a passion. I think it's so stupid. And this guy just makes it work, and he just made a really good clicker game, which is apparently possible to finance his game he actually wanted to make. And for me, that was a sign that I should just quit. that it was a good decision to stop, because I couldn't even have thought of that. I don't know how Twitch works. I don't know how to see how many people are viewing my stream. I don't like clicker games. I don't want to stream my development all day long, because if I pick my nose or something, people will see. So for me, it was just like, we're too old. Like, I'm turning 40 next week. And it's I don't know, it's time for something else for me. And I guess the clicker game moment was my moment when I realized that it was a good decision to stop. So.
Yeah. And I think after 20 years, for me, it's a little bit different. I don't want to quit right now. But like I said, we're not going to do anything new anymore. So I'm still working on some Switch things that we will announce later. Yeah, it's not going to be Rive 2 or Tokutori 3 or anything like that. And I like I said, I don't see there is any reason, unless there is a publisher coming out and saying, look, guys, we have a big bag of money for you, and you are making awesome games, and we want you to take all the time that you want for making this awesome game or sequel to Tokutori or Rive, and then perhaps Colin and I should have another talk. But the reality is that that's not going to happen. And if we want to do self-financing, it's just, no, it's not possible.
Well, even though, you know, this podcast has kind of the story has kind of a sad end. I mean, you guys have put together some really great games, like Tokutori and Tokutori 2 and Rive are all really, really great stuff. So, you know, it does get to that point that, you know, you're not making bad games. It's just, you know, getting the market to realize, hey, there's some great stuff out there is difficult, but I'm glad we have these games. Like, I have great memories of the original Tokutori, and, you know, you guys in a way, by reaching out to me to, you know, comment on that review that I wrote, whoever wrote that email, like, that was a little push for me to get into the games press at that point.
Oh, well, awesome.
So, to whatever degree I,
then as well.
That's right. Yeah. I feel like I owe you guys a little bit.
You repaid it with this podcast. So
yeah, well, I'm glad you can get your story out there, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, whatever you guys work on next, even if it's not necessarily video games.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, we'll keep you in the loop then.
And, okay.
Yeah, and
you have to give your consent, because now we cannot spam you anymore.
Oh yeah. On the GDPR.
That's right. So once that email comes, please, you guys have
the thumbs up.
Awesome. Okay, thanks.
All right, so I think we'll wrap here. But just to kind of conclude, do you guys want to let everyone know where they can find you online, what kind of projects you're working on that they can look forward to, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, well, everything is you can view everything on just twotribes.com or at twotribesgames on Twitter. We're mostly active on Twitter and the website. And we've released a few games on Switch now. So Rive is there, but also Tokutori 2 Plus and the original Tokutori. So take a look at those games, please. Martin said, we're working on, I think, two other Switch games that we haven't announced yet.
Yeah,
but they are from our back catalog.
And Tokutori 2 will get an update, and Tokutori 1 as well. So, and like I said earlier, when I took on the Switch projects, I wanted to end with obviously the best versions of those games that we've ever made. And I think if you look at Metacritic, for instance, Tokutori 2 versus the Tokutori 2 that was released on the PlayStation 4, it's just almost a full point higher. So we added a lot of extra stuff just, you know, to make it better. So the games that are now available on Switch.
Even if they already got it, it's still worth checking it out on Switch.
Definitely, yes.
All right. Well, it's great you guys were able to kind of, you know, I guess to a degree, end on your own terms and, you know, go out with sort of the definitive versions of your creations. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we did. I'm really happy with how we wrapped it up. Like, it's a game that we're really proud of. And I still play it sometimes, 2 years later, 2 years after wrapping up the design. So,
I'm pretty
happy with it still.
I mean, when we completed Tokutori 2 and we went bankrupt, if we would have ended back then, financially, perhaps it would have been better, which is a crazy answer, I guess. But, you know that I'm saying that because it's we were not able to recoup all the money that we spent on Rive through the sales, because otherwise we would have been able to make a new game. Financially, it probably would have been better after bankruptcy to quit the studio, but that would have been complete, from a, you know, from ourselves, from our own perspective, that would have been just like a very bad time. And I think by ending with Rive, with the bang, you know, shooting everything and making a game that we finally want to play in by ourselves, it was just the perfect ending. Mm-hmm. Even though it wasn't commercially okay, it could have been more perfect if it was commercially successful, but you know, it wasn't like that. At least we were happy to make it. I've been working on that game for almost 3 years with a big smile on my face, and with Tokitori, you should have seen me back then. It wasn't all that pretty. So, yeah, that's at least that we did. So,
and he is a pretty guy. So
I'm an awesomely pretty guy. Thanks, Colin. Thanks. Right.
Right. All right, guys. So that's not that sad an ending after all. So
yeah. No,
thank
definitely
you.
Not.
Thank you both for your time, and I look forward to seeing, you know, what's next, the final projects for Two Tribes.
Yes.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.